I mean, I'll tell you though, somehow watching this, like, you know, you click and you click and you click. Next thing you know, you're roped into like 35 minutes of Russian dash cam videos.
In a world where you only have trailers and posters to judge a movie, Jim and Ted strike out to answer the age-old question, will you see it?
Ted, it's Friday again. Here we are recording Trailer Junkies Podcast, one of my favorite nights of the week.
Definitely mine, even though it's Friday the 13th.
Yes. Actually, I should say perhaps it is my favorite night of the week. Anything exciting this week? How's everybody? How's Audrey's finger? Is everybody back healed? Anne's gums are okay?
Yes, everybody's on the mend. I go back to work on Monday. Anne is, you know, almost done with her antibiotics for her gums. Bryce is trying to, like, get hurt to get some sympathy, because everybody else in the family has some sympathy, but I don't know. He stubbed his toe a couple times, so we packed it in ice, but he's fine.
Like you said, he's bebopping along. Nothing's happening, so he decides, I'm bebopping along. Let me bump my toe and call Dad over here.
Exactly. Now, Bryce started a new soccer league this past week, so we're getting ready for that tomorrow morning for game one.
Cool. So Bryce is doing soccer.
How about you guys?
How about us? Let's see. First week back to work after spring break. I don't know. It's been kind of a quiet week, I guess, which quiet is good. I rebuilt an old grill, so I've been cooking on that thing. Life is kind of boring this week, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah, not much to write home about, you know, so I guess no news is good news. So with that said, we have three trailers kind of with a theme.
You drew a little comedic theme throughout these three movies. It's definitely a wide spectrum.
Yeah, so we have the Man Who Killed Don Quixote, Ideal Home, and The Meg. So the theme, well, maybe we'll get it going along, and maybe at the end we can recapture the theme and get back to that,
see if
anybody picks up on it. But how about we start with The Man Who Killed Don Quixote?
Definitely. We'll start with The Man Who Killed Don Quixote because they started with that movie first. I don't know if you did any research on how long. This movie's been in turnarounds for 20 years.
Yeah.
So Terry Gilliam started this in 1998. It originally had Johnny Depp and I think Robert Duvall or somebody else is the...
Yeah, it was Bob Duvall, yeah.
So those two were the original main characters, and then production stopped and started and stopped and started, and then finally now we have Kylo Ren and Jonathan Pryce going head to head on this, and the movie that finally came out.
What got me to look at the research on this was throughout the trailer, they keep taking jabs at themselves in a way, you know, 25 years in the making. What was the one it said? It said coming anytime soon. You know, and so there's all these different jabs they're taking at themselves. So I thought, you know, what on earth is going on? So I did some research and whatnot. And yeah, like you said, 1998 is when they started and they hit roadblocks with funding. And then Johnny Depp got busy with other movies and, you know, all these... I guess roadblocks, I don't know what you'd call them, but stops in production kept occurring. And, you know, 20 years later, it finally gets completed. So if for anything, it's a good story on how it got done. You know, I think it's a good making.
I went to film school about 15 years ago. So around that time, the terminology is called putting a movie in turnaround. Right. So when a movie is in turnaround, oftentimes it's a kiss of death, like movies go into turnaround and they never come out.
So turnaround means they get like recycled to get rewritten or refunded or whatever it might be and come back.
Yeah. You know, when you're putting a package together, you have the talent, the crew, and by the crew, you know, the top line, the directors and the producers and things like that, and the writers, and everybody has to come together in this mystical way that has to all line up in timing. And when things don't line up in timing, then it starts to fall apart. And then as things fall apart, as actors fall out, and as funding goes to other things, you know, the money that's promised here gets reallocated to another project somewhere else. So then they put it in turnaround. And usually, like I said, when I was in film school, turnaround meant the kiss of death, meant it's never going to get made. And then once a movie's gone into turnaround once or twice, then it's kind of got that black mark against it, and people don't want to touch it because nobody thinks it's ever going to get finished. So nobody wants to put in their chunk of change, $1 million or whatever, chunk of change, and then not have it working for them somewhere else in a project that might never get off the ground. So
Terry Gilliam, I mean, if nothing else, he's tenacious. Just to keep working through that scenario that you just explained over and over and over for 20 years. I mean, what's the typical turnaround for a movie? Not to use the term turnaround, but I mean, like turnaround, what I mean by that is like from conception of the idea, written, produced, and then marketed, and then gets out to the theater. I mean, 3 years, maybe 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, everything has its own timeline because you're talking about what people are putting into it. It's actually funnier. The bigger budgets actually have a more compressed timeline because when a movie is really, really big, they plan against it over the course of a decade. Like the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe, its movie structure is set, you know, through 2024, I believe, or something like that.
Okay.
And you're backing into dates with those movies. So that's why that's part of the reason you're paying all these actors, you know, $20 million a movie. You can pull them off of whatever they're doing and you'll get Chris Evans to do that movie for you when you need him to do it. So smaller movies, I think smaller movies, the movies like this that we're talking about, it can go 7 years to 3 years, you know? I think, who was it? It was Jordan Peele last year. He was talking about making Get Out. He took 7 years to write the treatment, you know? And then he took a few years to get it into script form. And then, you know, then once he had it in the final script form, I think the treatment was, he did all on his own. And then to switch from the full fleshed out treatment to a script, he had already been, you know, had it in the works. And then that was a shorter couple of years, I think. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, think about the tenacity and perseverance these people have. I mean, for one, you're betting on the come. So like you said, I mean, 7 years to write it and to get it into production, and how much money that you have to float yourself, maybe doing other jobs and things while you're working on this pet project that you might have, this little baby of yours. And then it gets to the point where you have to see this thing from conception of the idea through to the end to make it into the theater, which if you're looking at 7 years, 8 years, 10 years or something, I mean, you're betting on a lot of money to come later, and you really have to believe in this project and the patience. I mean, I don't know if I could hang on to something for that amount of time working at it, not getting paid, but anticipating a huge payout maybe or potentially down the road that may or may not happen.
And I think throughout that, you almost can't think about the payout.
It's your passion.
Passion project. You're reading my notes this week.
Yeah, it's totally a passion. Like you're doing it for the love of filmmaking, the love of the story.
The love of the story. And like you said, Terry Gilliam is a great foil for this, a great subject matter for this. Are you a fan of 12 Monkeys?
With Bruce Willis?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Terry Gilliam directed that. And okay. I was listening to the audio commentary on that too. Sorry, a bit of a movie nerd on that movie. I love that movie. So I took everything that you could from that movie. And I think Bruce Willis in an interview or the director's commentary or somewhere said, there's a scene where there's a mouse on a wheel in the background.
Uh-huh.
And Bruce Willis is getting dressed or putting on the hazmat suit in the foreground. And he set up the shot. Terry Gilliam set up the shot. And the mouse is doing its thing in the back. And, you know, Bruce Willis getting dressed. And he does it. And, you know, Bruce Willis is happy with his performance of dressing, you know, for this movie. And then Terry Gilliam is looking at the playback. And he's like, ah. And apparently the mouse, there was something about the way the mouse was not, he didn't spend the whole time in the wheel doing the mouse thing and the mouse in the little treadmill wheel. And I think Bruce Willis said they spent all day on this scene that he thought we'd wrap up in, you know, in an hour. But Terry wanted to get that mouse that's out of focus behind like a plastic sheet. That's just like a silhouette of a mouse in a mouse wheel.
You could have done a robot mouse at that point.
Or just like superimposed it, or if the mouse is doing what you want for half of the scene, then you could like...
You can loop it.
Nowadays you could do it, yeah. But he wanted it done perfectly the whole time. So some people would say you wasted a whole day on it, but this is the auteur filmmaking Terry Gilliam is used to. He's in control of the space. And even when the production isn't going on, to hold on to a passion project like this is an amazing feat.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's so funny because I watched it first with the French subtitles, and thank you for finding the English English cards, because it does add this tongue-in-cheek mentality to it that was completely lost to me. You know, like I didn't know that they're making fun of themselves in this trailer, which is great. It's a great additional layer. Even though he's held on to it for this long, let's not take it too seriously. You know, we'll be true to the period, true to the time, but we'll throw in modern day windmills and right next to the other windmills, you know?
Well, let's back up a second. So Ted sends me the trailers this week, as you know, he sends me trailers every week.
Yeah.
And I'm watching The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, and watching it, I'm thinking, why is this in French with English subtitles? Or no, I'm sorry, with French subtitles. So I watched the whole thing. I have no idea what the cards are saying or any of this stuff. So I just Googled the Don Quixote version in English. And sure enough, it's the first hit I find. So I dropped that one in on our show notes. And then I giggled because I realized after I did some research what was going on about how Don Quixote, or the man who killed Don Quixote took 20 years in the making, and you know, or, well, I guess the cards say 25 years, maybe that's with his writing, but
yeah.
But they were talking about how it took so long to make and how they said coming anytime soon and just all these little like slaps at themselves, which I thought was pretty funny. But the French version was lost on me. And the other thing, too, it's a time travel movie. So when you look at putting in, I don't know how he does time travel or how the guy from the 21st century gets there, but he starts off in 21st century London.
Yeah.
To go back to 17th century La Mancha, where Don Quixote then mistakes Sancho Panza as his squire. But Don Quixote's like from medieval times or something. So the whole thing is like this weird time shift.
Terry Gilliam did direct Time Bandits. So between Time Bandits, 12 Monkeys, the fluidity of time travel is definitely in Terry Gilliam's wheelhouse. And he does not give two bones about mixing it up that way.
I think it's just hilarious how his squire, from what you can gather, he's going back and forth between the 21st century London, 17th century, looking at what more or less is like Knights of the Round Table kind of jousting and all these things, bringing it through those time periods in a comedic way.
Yeah.
And what I think at the end, they show those like super fat cavemen.
The giants, yeah.
With like clubs and the giants, whatever. What I think that might be is somehow there's a scene in there where the time travel went astray and he wound up like, you know, 10,000 years ago or something.
Yeah, to me, okay, so I thought that that was a hallucination of Don Quixote, because Don Quixote, when he tilts at windmills, he thinks that the windmills are actually giants that are there to hurt the maiden or something. I think that's the thing, so...
So, okay, so you think the giants running with the clubs and such are windmills and not time travel gone astray?
Yes.
Gotcha. All right, I guess we'll have to find out.
We shall see. We shall see how that plays out.
Well, this also made it through the Cannes Film Festival.
Well, did it? One of the producers early on, one of the Portuguese producers of one of the earlier versions that was coming through tried to block it. So I think the fact that he blocked it made it not eligible for Cannes, but because everybody wanted to see it, they were able to screen it at Cannes.
Gah-ha.
Cannes got to see this movie, and it has nothing to do with Netflix. So when I read, like, you know, the legal problems jeopardize The Man Who Killed Don Quixote at Cannes, and I was like, uh-oh, is this a Netflix movie? Because did you hear about Netflix? Netflix, they're not screening anything at Cannes this year because they couldn't come to terms I haven't read the full article on this, so I don't think they've come to terms with their streaming service in France. And I think that was part of the negotiation was going to Cannes. And I think they've withheld it, like when we get blacked out from sports because all the cable providers are having their fights over here. So it's similar to that deal here in France. But yeah.
Yeah, oh, these guys.
But what do you think about that one scene? There's one scene at the end where driver's wearing like a white suit with a girl. And he's got the old windmills on one side and the new windmills on the other side. It's in one shot and it's like bridging the two times. I was trying to figure that one out. I think it's a minute 16.
The part that I think with the windmills, like you said, I think what they're just showing is the bridge between the 21st century and the 17th century, and it's the guy's travel between it. I don't think it, that was my impression anyway.
So he's just, this is one of the transition scenes where we have him moving between times. And this is the convention that the movie uses to get us from one time to the other time.
Exactly. So they're showing the modern day windmill, and then it fades into the old windmill. And it's to say, like, the way I'm reading it is to say that the time traveler goes from today to 300 years ago. And that's just the tool that they're using, or the medium that they're using to convey that message.
I like it.
I didn't read into it any further than that. You know, kind of here we go again, I think, with your typical trailer layout. You know, it starts going in one direction. It shows the fair maiden, you know, chivalry and adventure. And then, you know, after just 25 seconds or so, and boom, right into comedy and right into just goofiness when he hits the windmill and goes flying into the cart of beans or whatever it is. And but they give you the misdirection, as so many of these trailers do. They lead you down one path believing it's one kind of movie, and then about a third the way in, they change it on you. And now you're trying to just grasp at straws to figure out where you are, and then catch up to the story and be like, oh, okay, so what they showed me in the beginning was just an intro.
Right.
Not what this thing's actually about. But I think it's safe to assume it's a comedy. It's a comedy, right?
I think it's a comedy.
Yeah.
I think, you know, yeah, I think it's trying to fight. It's a period piece comedy, even though it switches from times, you know, between these time frames. I think there's enough in the past to go off of.
Yeah.
I think comedy is probably the top line of it, and the cards definitely do a lot to do that. It has all of Terry Gilliam's themes, so I don't think of him as straight comedy. Brazil is kind of a futuristic comedy. All of his movies seem to have a social allegory aspect to it. You know, he always has the, like we said before, he's got the theme of time travel, which is clearly in this movie. He has the other theme of sanity, which is awesome, because I think in 12 Monkeys, Brad Pitt's character is one of the best Brad Pitt performances of his career.
Wow, that's bold.
I love how crazy he is in that movie. And again, I'm sorry to keep going back to 12 Monkeys, but I guess it is my favorite Terry Gilliam movie. For that role, Brad Pitt was a young actor, hungry, you know, he was a star, but not, you know, not as big of a star as Bruce Willis at the time. And he went to an asylum to get some more experience. And he actually checked himself in without the name recognition. And he had done some research. So he had started doing some of the tics and some of the movements and some of the affectations that he ends up using in 12 Monkeys to portray himself as a person that is insane or going insane. And he had trouble getting out. He was so convincing that they were like, oh yeah, you need to be here. I'm sure you're a big actor. We know maybe you've broken. And the producers of the movie had to come and get him out. They had to like vouch for him and say, no, he was researching. He just did a really good job and he fooled you guys. So let him out because we need him for our movie.
You know, and that's what's great about like acting and stuff, is where people are so, like, great actors are so amazing. They get so entrenched in their roles that they lose who they really are. And they just live that role like flesh and blood to the point that they fool everybody because they get so deep into it. Like, that's what I see kind of. It's like where Johnny Depp gets into these roles and he becomes these bizarre characters. I guarantee you, he's like at home living this character, even offset, just to make sure that when he gets back on set, he doesn't confuse himself with the real Johnny Depp. Or maybe the real Johnny Depp is that bizarre. I don't know.
Oh, have you seen Jim and Andy?
No, I don't know what that is.
There's a Netflix documentary about Jim Carrey when he was doing the Andy Kaufman movie.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Oh, my God. If you like the idea of getting lost in your character, Jim Carrey channeled Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And throughout the filming of the movie, the people that knew Andy Kaufman were chilled to the bone because the things Jim was doing were things that were affectations of Andy Kaufman that no one outside of Andy Kaufman's circle would have understood. Like, you know, Danny DeVito, Andy Kaufman's girlfriend at the time, and a couple of his other, one of his producers, you know, they would be around Jim and Jim would be doing these crazy things when the cameras weren't rolling off camera, and he would just continue to play this role.
He got into the character.
He got so lost in the character. It's amazing.
The musical score, the dancing and so on, it's almost like kind of a Broadway show, the way they, I mean, obviously they're in forests and things. I mean, they're not on stage, but the dance choreography, the music, it seems pretty cool. I mean, I like the music. I like how it fits into the trailer, especially. I'm assuming some of the music's going to be in the movie.
Yeah, it feels like he has some epic dance sequences that he's set up in there to, you know, establish like a grand ball.
Yeah.
Old time filmmaking with, you know, the knight or the Prince Charming, you know, and the damsels in distress, you know. It's kind of an animated, you know, fairy tale, but, you know, a live action fairy tale. Which makes sense with the Don Quixote.
Yeah, this movie seems like it's a bunch of LARPers, or, you know, it's LARPing, the live action role playing.
Oh, yeah, I guess some of the LARPing is like full on chain. I know, yeah, now that you say that, like, yes, I knew guys in high school that would make their own chainmail. So that guy, you know, he was way into it.
So here's a funny one. So in the Army, we would have these health and welfare inspections. So like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m, all these like platoon sergeants and stuff with the first sergeant, they'd come pounding on the door, you know, health and welfare, get outside. I remember one said like, you know, Vancouver, you're on the list for a piss test. And I'm like, Sergeant, I didn't study. So anyway, we go outside and everybody's in formation. It's like 3 a.m, you know, I'm like, a Saturday or whatever, you know, and everybody just got to bed. People are like half in the bag still. You know, maybe we got back from a training exercise or whatever it might have been. But anyway, so First Sergeant says, all right, this is your amnesty. Anybody who has anything in their car they shouldn't have, this is the time to come forward. So, you know, some guys are like, you know, First Sergeant, you know, I have an open bottle of whiskey in the car or whatever, you know, like that I shouldn't have. Okay, well, bring it up here. Thanks for telling me. So this one guy raises his hand, and he was kind of a nerdy dude. He raises his hand. And I don't remember the guy's name, but the first sergeant says, all right, Private, what do you have in your car? You know, and he goes, I have a battle axe. And he goes, and the first sergeant's like, a battle axe? Like, what the hell do you have a battle axe for? Well, you know, when we come in from training and we have like a long weekend, we go out in the desert and we do LARPing. And he's like, LARPing? What is LARPing? You know, live action role playing. You know, and here we are at 3 a.m. Like, you know, there's guys doing push-ups and some guys, you know, like everybody's in trouble for doing nothing. You know, just how that's how the Army operates, I guess. But
yeah.
And this guy is given the finer points of why he has a battle axe in his car and the definition of LARPing. I mean, it was hilarious, you know, and we're just sitting there like trying not to laugh because nobody wants to be singled out, of course.
Yeah. You know,
it was one of those comedic moments that you don't forget.
That's awesome.
Of your time served, you know? Yeah. So I was thinking, will I see this? And I wanted to ask you if you're going to see it. What are your thoughts?
I think I could see it. I would love to get, you know, take Anne's temperature on the movie. And I think it's something she could get into. We'll probably see more spots about it and, you know, see if she gets excited about it. Then, you know, Frank and Barbara could watch the kids and maybe go actually have a night.
There you go. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's a little bizarre. It strikes me, minus the time travel, but it strikes me a little bit like maybe The Princess Bride or something.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. So I think Clarissa would be into this movie, quite frankly. We may see it in the same time frame that it took to produce it. You know, so between now and when Timmy graduates from college, we might be watching it.
So you're saying because it took 25 years to make, then like a wedding present, you should get 25 years to view it.
Yeah, totally. Why not?
Okay, so no spoilers for you until 25 years from whenever it releases.
Right. When you come over, I'll have some signal of like a picture of Don Quixote or, and then you'll be like, okay, now it's safe to talk. So really quick, who do you think is the man who killed Don Quixote?
It's got to be a squire, right?
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I don't know.
Yeah. But okay, so the one thing about watching trailers and stuff through YouTube, and maybe this is just watching anything through YouTube, is that the suggestions can pull you in for like the long haul. I mean, I'll tell you though, somehow watching this, like, you know, you click and you click and you click. Next thing you know, you're roped into like 35 minutes of Russian dash cam videos. You know, it's amazing how you could go from the man who killed Don Quixote to Russian dash cam videos with like horses running alongside cars and airplanes flying overhead and things falling from the sky. And
yeah.
Yeah. So the world of YouTube.
I got down a crazy rabbit hole today, of a trailer rabbit hole, I called it, where I started watching these three trailers and then it just started autoplaying all these trailers. And I'm like, ooh, that looks interesting. And then, oh, that looked interesting. And then 15 trailers later, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Well, and you have no idea how like the first one led to the 15th one, because they're not even close to the same kind of movie.
Right. Well, it's the algorithm of you, right? It's the algorithm of your viewing history and then your current viewing practice and then the current viewing trends. So we're confusing the algorithm by
Whoa,
doing this.
Ted, let's not tell everybody how you crack the code. I think we've beat this one up enough. Three-word review?
Three-word review is passion project defined.
Oh, man, to the max. I love that. Yeah, I mean, who sticks with a project that, you know, and this is, you know, okay, let's break this down a little bit. Like, it's different, you know, you go get a model race car as a kid, you know, like one of those plastic models, and you start building it, and maybe something happens, you put it on the shelf, you come back years later, you keep building. You're only in $9.99. I mean, in a little bit of time or whatever, right? Maybe you have to like replace some model paint because it dried up or something.
Yeah.
But this guy,
he had $30 million in 1998. That's the move. That's right. The money that was set aside for him to make this movie, and he couldn't get it done for whatever reason, but he stuck with it, and he had to, you almost have to re-raise that money every time you get this thing ball going. So it is amazing.
Yeah. And when you have big actors like Bob Duvall, Johnny Depp, and they just, for various reasons, they back out of your project, and then you have to go recast it. And you have to, I mean, talk about getting, you know, your desire and getting that story out there. Yeah, your three-word review is spot on for this one. No, I mean, you're right. It's a passion project to the max.
But see, to the max is already three words, so I couldn't use that.
To the max. Yeah, to the max. All right, let's do the ideal home to the max.
The ideal home is so different, we need to take a break.
Okay, but before we take a break, what's the release date, since we're talking about all this? It said 2018. That's it. I couldn't find a release date.
Maybe that's part of the joke. They finished the movie, but they have to clean up all of the producer credits. You know, I think what they can only have three producers listed on this. And I'm sure this one has 20 people that thinks that they played a significant part in making part of this movie.
Oh, the legal quagmire. Dude, this is a podcast episode in and of itself, but we won't do that. But you're right, though. The legal quagmire of 20 years of the people who came and went, the legacy that those people may or may not have imparted, or who are allowed to impart, incredible. Didn't even think of that.
I guess the release date is, it says it's released at the Cannes Film Festival. So it's the May 2018. That's the only thing that's there. And literally that producer that's holding it up is probably part of the reason.
Like you said, before we move on to Ideal Home, how about we take a break and we'll be back. Coming up on Trailer Junkies Podcast.
And we would play Kiss the Cougar, where my friend would take his cougar and we'd tie a sled to it and we'd spin the sled on a rope and then see who could come the closest to getting to the bumper of the cougar. And we call it Kiss the Cougar because you get dragged by the cougar and then the cougar stops and your sled keeps going and hopefully you don't slam your face into the back of the cougar.
If you enjoy our trailer reviews, or even if you hate them, let us know. We love feedback. We're on Twitter at TJunkiesPodcast and Instagram at TrailerJunkiesPodcast. You can also comment on the episodes at TrailerJunkiesPodcast.com. Our email is info@TrailerJunkiesPodcast.com. And you could also leave us a review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's get back to it.
And we're back.
All right. So Ideal Home. This one releases June 21st, 2018. Initial thoughts.
I'm loving the spectrum of Paul Rudd's work. You know, like he's going to have Ant-Man as a superhero movie, you know, with the comedic tones. And then this is just it's a classic family drama comedy. I think it's a misnomer to say drama first. It's a comedy that might have some dramatic scenes, probably three of them. You know, three dramatic scenes tops. You know, there's going to be a fight with the three of them. There's going to be a part where we think they're going to lose the grandchild, and then them coming back together. I think those will be the only scenes in the movie where we'll have anything other than laughter.
One of the things about it that I enjoyed was it had, so okay, a number of trailers we watch, and probably most trailers, they have that intro, and then they have that turn of events when it's at that point or that moment when the trailer takes that left turn that you weren't expecting, kind of like a First Reformed of last week. So yeah. It starts off, we're looking at this preacher priest guy, and you're thinking it's going to be like a religious cult, like about the occult and all these things, but then it becomes a terrorist bomber investigation movie and an angle you didn't see coming. This movie is sort of that, because it starts off and, you know, they show like the director, and you think like Paul Rudd, and you think he's this hard-nosed TV director, producer guy. And, you know, he's just like, who is this guy? You know, like he thinks he's, you know, like his, well, you don't know yet, but his boyfriend. And you think he's like, well, pardon the pun, he's ball busting. But then they get to the point where like you get into so far into it and you realize that now there's the real shift. And the real shift is now this kid comes in and Steve Coogan has, you know, the grandson, and, you know, then the family dynamics kind of come in, and then you see what the movie's about.
Right.
So it's like kind of the slight left turn that then brings you into like a bigger left turn.
No, it's amazing knowing about television and knowing the way some television production works. I love the way that they had some of the show within the show toolkit available for the trailer editors.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you look at the way they do transitions, they use that awesome, vivid, vibrant food photography of any stereotypical food show. So I love that they brought that into the trailer space. They put it behind the, instead of having your cards where your typical, you know, copy over black screen, it's over these beautiful still photography of half prepared food, you know?
In a sense, I guess it's an industry insider type of a movie, where the movie is about TV and production and directing. So you kind of, it's like pulling back the curtain slightly.
Oh, yeah.
To see what the life is on the other side of the camera.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looks like cute and funny and heartwarming, kind of a family movie, but I can't help but think how this movie will be polarizing in some way, for like politically, right? You know, where there's going to be a demographic of people who are just going to be completely offended. You know, they're going to say, this is the problem with Hollywood. It's all these gay shows.
My thought is that they got two straight guys to play these two gay characters. And the hot thing in Hollywood is to if you don't have the authenticity, you know, if you don't have a real handicapped person in a wheelchair, if you put an able-bodied person in a wheelchair as a production company, you're avoiding casting a handicapped person in that role.
It's a microaggression.
Yeah, something like that. So this is like, why are you putting straight people in gay roles? You're stealing all the gay roles from the gay actors. So, you know, it's almost like you have to thread a needle now. And is Paul Rudd playing his gay character kind of in a butch way? You know, throughout the movie, he's kind of, he could pass, even when he's saying, could we be any gayer? You know, it's like, I don't necessarily believe that he's gay until he gets paddled on the butt with a pizza knife or pizza pizza paddle, you know?
I don't know what the demographic is for the movie and who's really going to go see it. You know, what the box office take might be. And sometimes I'm surprised movies like this get made because they can be polarizing. So, you know, in other words, so you look at Infinity War coming out. That's one of those movies, like you were saying, you know, when we recorded that one, within 4 hours, there was 17 million views of the trailer.
Yeah.
So that just tells you that movie is going to take an enormous amount of money at the box office, because it just speaks to a huge spectrum, like a broad spectrum of society. Whereas a movie like Ideal Home, who is the audience? And I mean, it's risky for somebody to front the money or, you know,
To produce it. Yeah.
To produce it. Yeah. Because like, the box office take can't be that huge, I wouldn't think. It doesn't seem like it's going to be that type of a movie that's going to draw large crowds. And it's going to be, you know, at the political side of things, because of the nature of the subject matter, it seems like it's going to be politically polarizing, to where, you know, you just alienated half of your potential viewers, you know, who might go see this.
Looking this one up and figuring this one out, it premiered at the Mardi Gras Film Festival, the 2018 Mardi Gras Film Festival. So because
I didn't know there was a Mardi Gras Film Festival.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It's actually not in New Orleans. It's actually held in Australia.
Oh, no wonder I didn't know.
and it is a film festival for the LGBTIQ company. What's it called? Community. So that meaning, you know, it's open to that space. So maybe they'll be more accepting of it. Maybe there's more of a, maybe the director and more people involved in this have enough of this LGBTQ clout that they can put these mainstream actors in it and just say, hey, we need big names in here. And these big names are willing to do this, and they're making the movie better.
And then again, I mean, you know, somebody has to tell the story. So there's a story that they want to tell, and they're going to tell it. Doesn't matter what, I mean, if you're strictly thinking on the box office take, I mean, then how many movies would get made? You know, you're going to have, let me equate it to beer, right? So if you're thinking about how can we sell the most beer, we're stuck with Coors Light.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. But there is a market for bourbon stouts and IPAs and various flavors of porters and there's a market for those craft beers, right?
Yeah.
It might not be...
It's not going to be as big. It's a smaller market.
It's not going to be as big. You're not going to have as huge money. But at the same time, it seems like the set for this movie is, what, one rich dude's house that he put up probably. And who knows? Maybe he donated it and said, hey, I want the story. I like the story. I want it told.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll volunteer my house for it or something.
I think the funny thing about films and movies in general, especially in the theater, and I think this is part of the reason that it can get disrupted so easily by Netflix and streaming services, and as it's getting disrupted right now, is that whether the company spends what do we want to say, $300 million on Infinity War? $250 at least. If they spend that much money, and then this movie gets made, Ideal Home, right? And they spend $20 million, or I don't even know what the budget was for that, but, you know, Don Quixote, who killed Don Quixote, had a budget of 16 million euros, you know? So when they both go to the theater, you don't get charged more or less. You all get charged the same amount. So the there is no demand economy. You know, it's not supply demand. It's not like when you buy a craft beer and you buy a Coors Light, I know that I'll probably pay, what, twice as much for that craft beer, right?
Ted, one question for you.
Yes.
What to you was the funniest part, like laugh out loud, of this entire trailer?
So to me, my favorite part, and it's weird because I think you and I have both talked about this movie, and I think we've said, well, we haven't seen Brokeback Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
But when the social worker shows him the movie, and it's the gay porn of Brokeback Mountain, and Steve Coogan says, that is actually funny because the original source material is also a gay cowboy movie.
Yeah. Well,
and he's wearing that shirt. What does his shirt say? I shaved my balls for this.
Well, right. She's talking to them about that stuff. But the best part was, like, they both have this look of confusion. Like, why am I being scolded for the type of movies I like to watch? You know, whatever it is, right? And he's got this thing, I shaved my balls for this? I'm eating lunch watching this, and I'm just like, okay, here we go. You know, I'm just, whatever it is, I'm just watching, like, that, Quixote, this one, and then what we're going to do next to Meg. Sure. It's my lunch break. It's time for trailer watch, right?
Yeah.
Man, I about lost my lunch. I was laughing so hard when I saw that pink shirt. where do you wear that thing? I mean, that is just incredible.
Your boyfriend bought it for you and you wear it around the house, you know?
I guess. I mean.
And I do want to say that, you know, I don't think we've ever talked about wardrobe before. But to me,
no, we never have, actually.
I think Paul Rudd, like I said before, it's ambiguous how well he's pulling off the gay man in this movie. But his wardrobe throughout this thing is spot on, I think, you know, his wardrobe and
the tight jeans
and the way that he's his Ant-Man body that he's like buffed out. It's like he's all about, like, to me, that is the stereotypical, which again, I don't know, like, is that a good or a bad thing? You know, when he answers the door in the shirt with it's like the tight tank top, but it's striped, you know, it's like, oh yes, okay, perfect. That and then the beard.
The seafoam green Speedo.
Complete with the snap at the the leg band.
Completely ludicrous. I mean, but no, it looks funny. I'm probably not going to watch it, you know, but I don't know. Maybe I would. It would go back to one of those accidental viewings that I've talked about. You're sitting on the sofa. Hey, what should we watch tonight? You know, you're thumbing around. It's on streaming and you're like, eh, whatever. We talked about it on Netflix. We talked about it on Trailer Junkies podcast. Like, yeah, we'll watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it would be next. I don't know if I'd go to the theater for it, but definitely an accidental viewing.
It has to end well. I mean, I don't, you can't end this any other way. I love the way that the Taco Bell is kind of laced into it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's brought into the beginning very lightly. And then there's one scene where they're like, they've got the bottle of wine out at Taco Bell while they're at Taco Bell. And they've just kind of, it's this ability, this giving up that only parents understand, like, to be a parent and to give in and to give up on fighting your child on something, I think is one of the great kind of mysteries of parenting, when you like, that won't kill them, so let's just do Taco Bell. We do fast food maybe once a month, but when the kids get in there, it's like a church to them. They love it. They're like in awe of everything, and it's all so bright and colorful.
Taco Bell! Taco Bell! Taco Bell! Taco Bell!
So at the end, when they're chanting Taco Bell, and Paul Rudd is like cheering them on, just to get Steve Coogan's goat. You know, it's just perfect.
Well, and it's so funny that you say that because, I mean, there are times when, you know, I remember before Clarissa and I had kids, oh, we're not going to be like that. Oh, we're going to give our kids, you know, broccoli and vegetables and all this good. And we do. I mean, I'm not saying we don't, but like, right. We're going to do all this stuff. We're going to be perfect. And then like,
but every day is a struggle and you just got to feel like
they just wear you down, man. They wear you down, you know, to the point where you're just like caramel corn. Yes. Caramel corn. You can have all you want. Just please, not on the sofa. Like, caramel corn isn't the battle at that point. It's just don't put it on your sticky hands on the sofa, you know? Like, you're just, like, your lines in the sand become just so just blurred to the point where you're just so beat down, you know?
Yeah. And he gets thrown up on in the picture booth. It's like,
oh yeah.
Brutal. Last week we had the alien throwing up, you know, and now we have, you know, Steve Coogan catching a lot of puke, vomit, and then having to pose for pictures.
You know? Lime green.
That's right.
Pretty brutal. All right. I don't know. You have anything more to add? I said what I needed to say.
No, I think it's great. Three word review for this. I was struggling for this one. It has something to do with like three men.
Oh, I thought that was it. I was struggling.
No, it had to do with like three men and a little kid or something like that. Those are way too many words. Or two men and a two and a half men or something like that. But I couldn't figure it out. And then
I see the angle you're going for.
And then maybe just gay aunt dad. I think we'll just go with that.
Okay, sure. Gay aunt dad. All right, moving on to the Meg. So what do you think? It's this generation's Jaws or is it more comedic or I don't know. I mean, I have a few things I need to say about it too, but I mean, what's your initial thought?
It didn't ever hit me as Jaws. The only thing that hit me as Jaws was some of the posters I saw for it. It was really funny, you know, when I said I got caught in the trailer rabbit hole today, one of the other trailers I saw was the new Jurassic Park trailer.
Uh-huh.
And that has a megalodon in it as well.
Well, there you go.
So is this like a Jurassic Park underwater?
Okay, let's start from the beginning.
Okay, from the beginning, August 10th, 2018 is the release date.
Okay, August 10th, there you go. Biggest complaint. I have a few complaints about this one. One of the complaints I do have, though, right in the beginning is the opening text is up for 1.5 seconds. I hit play, and by the time I move my face or my eyes from the play button to look at the screen, it was already fading out.
Right.
So I'm like, well, I missed it. I got to go back. So I did that again, and I'm like, I missed it again. So I hit play, and I paused it really quick to read it, and then I hit play again. I mean, it was just too fast. They needed to hang on that, I think, just a little bit longer.
Or do you need it at all? I was thinking, like, As I did what you just said, because obviously that's what you have to do to read it. It's like, if that's the case, if you're not going to leave it up there long enough for people to do it, it might matter for the movie that you're 200 miles off the Chinese coast. It doesn't matter for the trailer.
I guess if I have to have a complaint, that was my first complaint. I thought it was cool how they make you, or well, they leave in question, not they make you believe, but they leave in question what happened to the girl. And as everybody goes running, and then you find out she's okay, which I'm happy because she's a cute kid. But man, how thick must that glass be to where it didn't break? And after getting hit, it didn't crush under the pressure. That's some serious glass.
Yes. And why are they standing around? I'd be getting out of there, you know, because there is stress on that glass.
Get out!
It's like standing on a lake after it's been cracking under your feet. It's not a safe place to be. My high school friends and I used to play a game called Kiss the Cougar. And when the lake by one of my friend's house would freeze over, it was like a parking lot that went into a lake. And we would play Kiss the Cougar, where my friend would take his cougar and we'd tie a sled to it. And we'd spin the sled on a rope and then see who could come the closest to getting to the bumper of the cougar, and we call it Kiss the Cougar because you get dragged by the cougar and then the cougar stops and your sled keeps going and hopefully you don't slam your face into the back of the cougar.
Yeah, hopefully.
But there were plenty of times we were out on that lake and we're like, the car's not on the lake, but we're on the lake trying to get dragged across the lake.
Yeah, I got you. You know?
But
that's very Darwinistic of you.
Yeah, it's like, why are we doing this when it's like the summer's coming, you know?
So the beginning text is a complaint for sure. Here's the biggest complaint I have of this movie, though.
The trailer.
And that is...
The trailer or the movie?
Trailer. Okay, trailer. Well, movie too. It's probably the same.
Okay.
But they discover Megalodon, an enormous dinosaur shark.
Prehistoric shark, yeah.
Prehistoric shark that's 2 million years old, they thought was extinct, and they discover it. Research be damned. We got to find it. We got to kill it. Really? You just discovered something that's the Megalodon. It's enormous. Like, okay, Rainn Wilson, he's going to be the comedic relief in this, I have a feeling.
Yeah.
And he makes the comment in the trailer, well, why don't you just put a tracker on it? You did watch Shark Week, didn't you? I mean, if anything, let's assume it's as dangerous as they're portraying it to be, because I don't know where the hell the thing's been for the past, like, few dozen centuries. Okay, so your beaches are threatened and boating is threatened or whatever. Put some tracker on it with a beacon, go into satellites, radioing where this thing is.
And just steer clear.
How it reproduces is anybody's guess, but whatever. I'll suspend that belief.
Oh, that's the Meg 2.
Yeah, exactly. But can you imagine Sharknado with this? Like the one fish takes out the Empire State Building, you know? So maybe you're pinging off satellites and, you know, and your radio and heading towards Brazil, clear out the Brazilian beaches. So the people of Brazil are like, whoa, we got to get out. Megalodon's like the whole world's going to know about this thing. It's not like nobody's going to know. I mean, yeah. You know, it's the Megalodon for crying out loud. It's on every news station. So you put a tracker on it. You know where it is, where it's going. It's probably territorial. It's probably hanging out in like the same waters, fairly deep, I would imagine. But yeah, let's say it's not. Hey, send radio signal ahead and be like, hey, the Megalodon's heading for your beach. Clear out. We'll let you know when he's through. You can go back in. But why is it human nature that when you don't understand something or you fear something, the first reaction, you got to kill it?
Yeah.
And everybody's going to shoot and blow it up. God, it's so annoying.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it is a weakness of the writing of this movie. I think that's the part of it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm a huge John Turteltaub fan. He's the director of this. He directed National Treasure movies. He directed one of my favorite movies, Phenomenon, which doesn't fit this genre. But he's done a lot of movies that I really love. So that gives me a little more leeway in trying to figure out what this movie is. It's not going to approach being worth The Abyss.
Right.
But it might be fun on the level of Jurassic Park, so to speak. To me, another big problem that I have is that the scale of the Meg, it seems to shift.
I was going to say that the scale changes depending on what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. Sometimes he feels a lot smaller than what we see when we see like the wider the shot is, the bigger the shark is. You know?
Right, right.
And I'm like, is it supposed to be parallax? Then when you look through it into water, it's actually bigger than it is. But, you know, the poster that I chose for this week has that huge mouth coming to swallow this whole yacht up. Maybe it's a yacht, maybe it's a cruise ship, you know? And yet, when in some of the scenes with Jason in it, he's only as big as the mouth. Well, that both those things can't be true at the same time. So that's the thing that really bothers me throughout this is like, are those other sharks? Because that's the only thing I kept thinking was the logic of this is that maybe he's a shark hunter and we're seeing early scenes that we're establishing that he's a really good shark hunter and he goes face to face with these other sharks.
Yeah. And what you're saying is there's megalodons.
There's either megalodons or they're just other regular great whites that he battles on a regular basis.
Oh, I gotcha. Well, and the other thing that kind of annoys me, and this is just going into the lore of what a great white, let's say, does, is that, you know, when you hear it's like, oh, shark attack, you know, shark attack the surfer, you know, out here at the beach or whatever, when people are surfing. I mean, attack has like malicious intent, I would say. You know, you happen to look like his food and he was hungry.
Yeah.
So he decided he was going to try and eat you, you know, because you looked like a seal. And then he realized, wait, this guy has like a styrofoam board under him. Well, not that he knows what styrofoam is, but, and you're not really what I'm looking for. So I'm going to spit you out. It just so happens I bit through your kidneys and liver, you know, but you're not what I really want to eat. You know, it wasn't like, oh, there's a human and humans have killed sharks through the millennia. I'm going to attack you and gain vengeance on my kind, you know,
for my mom.
Yeah. That's what I kind of think about when I hear, like, you know, attack. And this movie or trailer, even when they, you know, the Megalodon comes up and it takes out the boat, you know, and all these things, what he wind it almost appears as though, like, he has malicious intent, because you are in his water and if you don't leave, I'm going to take you out.
Right.
It just seems
too far-fetched.
Not just too far-fetched, but too far beyond what's reasonable for how people would probably react if we, in fact, did find something this big in the ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think our first reaction would be just gun it down.
Oh, no. And I think, like you said, Rainn Wilson is going to be our comedic relief throughout this thing.
Right.
And then they have that song, Beyond the Sea. When they're playing Beyond the Sea throughout the second half of this trailer, it's like, we're not taking ourselves too seriously. Not, you know, don't worry about, like, how big the fish is. You know what I mean? It's like, don't worry about a lot of these things. We're just going to have fun.
Yeah. And that little, what is he, a Yorkshire Terrier or something, jumps yeah. in. And then he gets so far from the boat and he's all, whoo. And you see him, like, he's like, I got to get out of here. You know, he starts pedaling back. I mean, the poor little guy, I hope he doesn't get eaten. I mean, the thing is, he would be like, you know, a kernel of corn for, if you want to size it up. You know, okay, here's a question. Do you think they're going to give any explanation or anything to where it may have been all the years that we never seen it or have heard of it or anything before? Or is it going to be something like, all the legends are now just confirmed?
Oh, no, I think there's going to be some awful exposition that will be early on in the movie and slow the whole thing down. And they'll probably keep it in there just to keep the narrative going. I think we've seen it because, you know, that whole
the big squid.
Yeah. The big squid, like you were saying, we were talking about the copy on the first shot. They don't even need that whole first shot. You don't need to be above water to see the base. You could start with a girl underwater and you have the same exact effect, right?
Totally, yeah.
You eliminate that heliport that's on the that's if you show people underwater, we don't as humans, as ground air breathing humans, we understand that they came from the surface and we went down and there's some kind of underwater base, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of logical things that we're over explaining, and maybe it's because it's a multinational production. When you release a movie in these markets, I think we've said this before, the Iron Man, the first two Iron Mans, because it needed to be a Chinese co-production, they had to shoot extra scenes and have Chinese actors in it so that they can get into the 1 billion or, you know, billion plus market of China. So I think this is another one of those movies that is playing the game to hit a larger share of the audience and get the Chinese market.
Well, and I was thinking, what was that TV show or movie? I think it was a movie like in the 70s or something. What was it, The Lost World or something?
The Land of the Lost? Is that the one?
The Land of the Lost? Is that what it was? Where, like, they found their way into, like modern man went to dinosaur time, 60 million.
That prehistoric, yeah.
Yeah. So this might be like a portal in reverse order, where those sea creatures somehow found some portal to bring them to here, because there is that huge squid scene, and there's, you know, other enormous sea creatures that present themselves that otherwise, I mean, yeah, they don't exist. Well, not that we know, I guess. The megalodon, every shark week, they're always looking for megalodon.
Because you never know. The Marianas Trench.
You know, the one thing this movie, or, well, again, I keep saying movie, but the one thing this trailer has done, it's reinforced my fear of going in the water.
The open ocean is terrifying.
I mean, I'll go up into my ankles at least, right? But, you know, you go out to the open ocean and all of a sudden, I mean, how do I know there's not going to be a megalodon? I mean, just because no one's seen it yet doesn't mean it ain't going to eat me.
You don't want to be the first.
That's right. So let's see, where else are we with this? Like I said, Rainn Wilson, I think, is going to be pretty funny. Probably a role that he's going to be not unfamiliar with. I mean, he's going to be the, like I said, the comedic guy. He, you know, not just comedic, but I think he's going to be your level-headed, like, well, hey, we haven't thought of this first. Let's try that before we go to this. You know, he's going to be that kind of guy, you know, like keeping the logic in check and everything.
The problem solver.
I think you're going to have people jumping to conclusions, and he's going to be the guy to, like, rein you back in. Rein. And say, well, let's not jump to conclusions. Let's just, you know, like the tracking thing, for example. Like, well, why are we going to kill it? Why not just track it?
Who do you think that Rainn Wilson is going to be the one to say?
You're going to need a bigger boat.
When we hit at a minute 50, when he takes out the boat, my first impression was they need a bigger boat. And then overall, though, I mean, this looks like it takes place in China mostly.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking Brazil was part of it, but then that's not like the big Jesus. That was some other statue.
Right. It's the big Buddha, I think, or
the big or whatever. Yeah. So this is a China thing. So
have you seen Deep Blue Sea?
No, I have not.
To this day, Deep Blue Sea has the best shark scene of any movie. So we'll put it in the show notes. But the minute I saw this, I was checking around, and they're actually making a, it looks like they're making a sequel to Deep Blue Sea, and it's going to be awful. So do you know Thomas Jane, right?
Yeah.
Thomas Jane is like, he plays similar to this Jason character in The Meg, and they're in an underwater thing. And Sam Jackson is the scientist, and he's kind of having everybody calm down. And he gives this great speech, calms everybody down. Rappaport's losing his stuff over the whole, you know, the sharks attacking and stuff. And he gives this great long speech. And right in the middle of the speech, a shark comes up and snatches him out of this little portal.
Now, you've seen how bad things can get and how quick they can get that way. Well, they can get a whole lot worse. So we're not going to fight anymore. We're going to pull together and we're going to find a way to get out of here. First, we're going to seal off this...
Just an amazing, like, a play on the whole shark movie space. So
unbelievable. I hope I didn't steal your, well, though you didn't, you said it wasn't. I was going to say, I hope I didn't steal your 3-word review with this generation's Jaws.
No, that is a appropriate 3-word review for it. But my 3-word review is going to poke more fun about the current movie climate and another movie that's coming out this week. Rampage. So Rampage is coming out today, and my 3-word review for The Meg is not The Rock, because this Jason Statham character feels like it's tailor-made for The Rock, but The Rock is just too busy to be doing all these movies.
Oh, that's all the guy keeps coming out. I mean, every time you turn around, The Rock's got movies. He's in that HBO football TV series.
Yeah, Ballers. And he's got this new movie, Fighting with the Family, where he plays a WWE wrestler. He has people that want to be wrestlers. The teaser for that is great, because there's the two main actors and then The Rock. And The Rock is walking out, you know, and he's like dressed in normal street clothes. And these two main actors are like, Dwayne Johnson, we love you. And he comes over to them and basically he just goes, you know, extemporaneous, as if he's in the ring back in the day, giving a spiel that he had to give. Whether if it was scripted, he does such a good job acting like it's not, that, you know, it's just, he pours so much of himself into it.
What are your names again?
My name.
It doesn't matter what your names are. You walk around here interrupting the Rock, you like you haven't seen the sun in 20 years. You like you just stepped out of Oliver Twist. Please, sir, may I have some more advice, sir? You want some advice? Here's the Rock's advice. Shut your mouth. What you want? What you want? How about what the Rock wants? The Rock wants you to go out there, take no prisoners, have no regrets, have no fear. Lay it all out on the line. Because if you don't do that, the Rock is going to find your friend Mary Poppins. He's going to take her umbrella. Yeah, he's going to shine it up real nice. He's going to turn that sumbitch sideways and stick it straight up your candy asses. There's your advice. Straight out of the jabroni beating, pie eating, trail blazing, eyebrow raising, entertaining the globe never hotter, talking to two rejects from Harry Potter. So that's how you win over the crowd.
So this one is for the Meg. I'm sorry, Jason. You're like an awesome, handsome Rob. You know, like he's a great actor in his own regard, and he has franchises, action franchises to his name. But the Rock and Jason are in the new spin-off franchise from Fast and the Furious. And when we were all together with Frank and Barbara, I was like, oh, we should do Fast and the Furious and do some kind of Fast and Mesozoic or Fast and Prehistoric or something like that. But none of that was really working. So I went with Not the Rock.
Not the Rock. I thought you were going to say Not Roy Scheider.
You can do it.
Yeah. It's funny how so many of these movies have been done before. I mean, it's like when you look at Infinity War, you know, and you look at how like they get so big that you can't get any bigger, right? So Jaws, again, it's this huge shark.
Yeah.
And I remember too, like Jaws 3 in 3D, like he follows him down to the Caribbean and all this stuff, whatever, you know. But I mean, the whole point is, so, you know, the original Steven Spielberg Jaws, though, where the shark was like really big and fierce and just all the Jaws was. But it's like you can't do that story anymore. Now you have to do the biggest shark ever known to the planet. And it's almost like once that's finished, well, then now what shark movie are you doing? You know, like you've just finished all the shark movies because you've just done the biggest shark.
Well, I think the brilliance and the beauty of Jaws was accidental, you know, and Spielberg is a great director. And he knows how to tap into an audience. But the time in his career that he made Jaws, I think he fully admits that if the shark that they had built for the production had worked better, that they would have a completely different movie. But the fact that the shark didn't work and the fact that the shark was malfunctioning all the time made him have to manufacture the tension. And actually that manufactured tension, it makes a better movie than the movie that they would have made if the shark was jumping out of the water, or if they thought, oh, we can fix it in post. We'll just have that ugly thing that doesn't really look like a shark when it comes out. And then in the post, we'll CG a real shark or a real looking shark and have it look so much better. That in and of itself shows like a development out of necessity. Whereas you take someone like John Krasinski, who we love to talk about. So he did some interviews about this movie because it's so phenomenal. And the way he's thought about building suspense and building and layering in tension, I think he's really more of a student of it at this point in his career, where, you know, he can be this auteur for this movie that impresses everyone all the way up to Stephen King. You know, I think when you have like Jaws as your template, then you have a wave of movies after it that try to repeat the tension, but they get the wrong point. They take the wrong point. They take the shark and they do that. And I have a feeling we're going to have a whole wave of movies that are going to be like, oh, all we have to do is not talk through the whole movie. And that will heighten the tension.
it's not necessarily best to be better, but it's more important to be different, right? So in A Quiet Place, for example, where there's really no talking, like you said, now there's going to be a wave of, and I have no doubt you're right, you know, there's going to be a wave of movies where people don't talk because Hollywood gets into these like frames of mind where they do all of these monsters and they do all of these big cats. They do all this stuff, you know, not now it's all dinosaur stuff, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's everybody's trying to be better than the last movie to just get the next box office hit or whatever. But what makes like A Quiet Place so good, or even Jaws for that matter, is it's just different. It's never been done before. Or maybe it has, but enough time has passed to where this generation doesn't know that something similar was done 20, 30 years ago or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then coupling being different with limiting yourself to certain constraints, those constraints then are going to bring out your creativity rather than just throwing just tons of CGI and, oh, well, don't worry about the shark. We can always just add a shark later.
Yeah.
No, like that's all you have is this mechanical shark that's still at Universal Studios, like backlot ride. But the brilliance of it, though, is that those constraints are one of the reasons why you've had, like you said, the accidental success.
No, it's amazing.
Anyway, do you think you're going to see this, the Meg?
No, I think I'm going to watch the Phenomenon on TV or my DVD. I'll put my DVD of Phenomenon out and I'll watch John Travolta and Kara Sedgwick in a brain cancer love story.
Oh, there you go. That sounds like a lovely one. I mean, think about this, though. You watch all the Jaws movies, and you go in order, too, right? What was the one you said, Deep Blue Sea?
Deep Blue Sea.
So you watch all the Jaws movies, which goes into Deep Blue Sea. After that are all the Sharknadoes. Yeah, all the Sharknadoes. And then you top it off with the Meg. You just go, it's Shark Week, like your own Shark Week.
Your personal Shark Week movie marathon.
I don't know. Jaws, it won some Academy Awards, didn't it?
Best score, 1976. John Williams.
Oh, yeah. I mean, best film editing, best sound mixing, best picture nominee. Okay.
So it was editing and the music and the sound, right?
You're talking about a solid movie. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah. He's cutting to reaction shots of people reacting to things that he wanted to happen, but he couldn't get to happen. You know what I mean?
So. No, you know what he's cutting to? You know what he's cutting to? The shark breaks down and you see Roy Scheider going like, son of a bitch. But really, they cut that right into like something that happened in the movie. And here it was just his reaction to like having to do the scene over again.
Yeah.
But it wound up that they used it in the actual film, you know, I mean, like, and I guarantee you that stuff happened.
And it's the dolly zoom, that Hitchcock zoom that he uses on Roy Scheider on the beach all the time. And yeah.
Right.
Amazing. Camera work and editing.
What do you say we call it and we'll get out of here? And
awesome.
All right, Ted, I had a great time this week, man.
Thanks, Jimmy.
I could keep going.
All right, have a good night.
All right, man, you too. It was good talking.
Bye.
Next week, join Jim and Ted as they disarm another Hollywood bomb or marketing masterpiece. Remember, the holy trinity of podcasting. Subscribe, like, share.
Special thanks to Jeremy Kent Jackson for the voiceover and Rahelio for the music.